Before we begin this episode of The Grave Talks, I want to let you know we're presenting it in one full piece and not broken into two parts due to the magnitude and nature of this topic. We felt this story should be presented in its entirety to anyone who chooses to listen. That being said, some of the subject matter discussed on today's episode may be upsetting, so personal discretion is advised. Today on The Grave Talks, the spirits of United 93. In the fall of 2001, while the world struggled to recover from the disasters of September 11th, 2001, writer Patty Wilson was contacted by a security guard who had a chilling encounter to share, but did not know who or how to share it. The world at the time was struggling to go on day to day, and there was little room for ghost stories to be told in such dangerous times. However, Robert Wagstaff wasn't out to tell a story for attention. He simply wanted someone to listen and possibly make sense of the encounters and experiences he was having at the tragic crash site of United 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Late one night, Patty Wilson sat down with Mr. Wagstaff in a small pizzeria parlor to hear his story. Today on The Grave Talks, we hear that story as told by Patty Wilson and what was discussed late that night in the pizza parlor. The experiences Mr. Wagstaff had keeping watch over the crash site of United 93.
So probably at the time I would have been ghost hunting about 20, 25 years and had written probably about 14, 15 books by then. So everybody in Pennsylvania, particularly Central PA, knows me as the ghost lady. And I, you know, I'm well known. So, of course, the drama and the horrible trauma of everything that happened was very recent. It's not far from here, like 45 minutes from my house. Mm-hmm. And we've all kind of gone through all of that emotion. I think that there's not a person who survived, you know, lived in that time frame that doesn't know where they were the moment this happened.
Sure.
So months have gone by and I wasn't thinking about it, to be honest with you, not at all. And a friend of mine who is a ghost hunter up in Cambria County, which is where Johnstown is, contacted me one day and she said, "Hey, there's this guy that got a hold of me and I don't know what to do with him. I think he's legit, Patty, but his story, if it's true, it's way too big for me." And I wasn't sure what she was talking about. She gave me a little background that he worked as a security guard, that he had been at the crash site and he had seen something. So I was in general prepared for it. And at the end of the day, whatever else I am, I'm always a writer. So there's not a writer on the planet who would be honest and tell you they wouldn't have been excited to have that opportunity to talk to somebody who was at the crash site, who has a story to tell that was virtually unknown. Mm-hmm. So I agreed to meet them. And it was kind of like a movie, I have to confess. It was a rainy, cold, miserable night. I drove up the mountains through the fog to Johnstown and was supposed to meet them at this little pizza shop in a little village right outside of Johnstown called Winbur. And I pull into the parking lot. It's 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and the pizza shop is shutting down. And there's two cars. One I recognize as my friend's car. And there's this other little like black sports car type thing. And I go inside and I look around. There's nobody sitting in any of the booths. And I look at the guy who's kind of wiping things down. And I said, "I'm here to meet somebody." And I named my friend. And it was like something out of a movie. He nodded his head and he pointed to the back and he said, "She's back there." And I'm like, "Okay." So I went past a curtain and into this little, must have been a break room. And there sat this mountain of a guy. He was a bodybuilder. I mean, that's what he did. He weightlifted. And my friend, and she got up and very quickly introduced me. And we sat down and talked a couple moments. And the first thing he said to me was, she tells me that I can trust you. And I said, yes, I hope you can. I'll do my best. And I always keep my word. And he kind of looked me up and down a little bit. And he said, Inside Edition's been hounding me for 3 days for this story. And I don't want to tell it to them. And I said, why do you not want to tell it to them? And he's like, it's not about me getting famous, lady. It's about me getting the word out in such a way as that their families, the, you know, the dead people, their families will know that some of them are still up there. And I just sat down and I asked if I could record. And he said, yes. So I put a recorder on the table. I said the time and date and the place, the name of the people there. I asked them to each agree verbally that they were willing to be taped, and they did. And then my friend got very quiet, and the guy just started. And when he was done with the interview, I was awestruck. What he had to say was an amazing story, and I was blown away as a writer, knowing that I was going to get to write this story. And the last thing he said to me, And I kind of skipped over the story because that's going to be the gist of everything, was sure. That he was counting on me to make sure that people knew, but I didn't turn it into no damn circus.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuck with me. So when I'm sitting down to write the story, I had sold it to Fate magazine. And I sat down to write the story, and I'm looking at it, trying to figure out a way to do it without making it overly dramatic. I wanted to just tell what he said.
Yeah.
So in the end, I came up with the idea of, I'm just going to put the interview down verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. And when it came out, oh my gosh, within a day, maybe two, the anger and the hate that came flying out at me from people was really amazing. I really didn't anticipate it. And it wasn't so much from strangers. It was people who knew me in the general world as a writer or a ghost hunter. And, you know, I got a lot of, it's way too soon for this shit. I can't believe you dare do this kind of things. I thought you were a good person, and now I can see you're nothing but, you know, fill in the blank.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking to you ever again. You're not going to get invited to this conference. So this isn't going to happen. And I just sat there and sat and held my ground. And I wasn't rude to anybody. I would just say, I'm truly sorry you feel this way. I just thought it was a story that needed to be told.
Yeah.
And that's what my job is as a writer. I'm to tell the story. I didn't add to nor take from it anything. So that's how it kind of went. And then every time I would try to put it in a book, because, you know, as I said, I write books. And so I would I wrote Haunted Pennsylvania and a bunch of other books that have Pennsylvania themes that were paranormal in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And my editors would say, don't you have any really great, like, fantastic stories? And I'm like, oh, gosh, do I ever. And I put it into the book because I have a lot of leeway with my writing and sure. What I put in. Then the book would come back and the story would always be edited out.
Yeah.
And I had the same editor for 9 years. So I would go to my editor and I'd say, I don't understand. It's a great story. And he's like, oh, it's an amazing story. I love it. But every time I take it to the editorial review board, they shoot it down because they feel it's too controversial. And I'm like, okay. So eventually I decided to put out a couple books of my own, and I put it in one of those because I wanted the story to be out. I still, to this day, believe I did the right thing. If it cost me 20 friends, I still believed I did the right thing. I didn't add to nor take from that story in any way. I told exactly what that man asked me to tell. And by the way, Robert Wagstaff, the gentleman that I interviewed that night, never sold the story out to anybody. He didn't talk to Inside Edition. He didn't talk to anybody. And I do know that they actually did call him. I do know that he got emails from other quasi-news organizations like Inside Edition that were offering him large sums of money to tell his story, or were offering him fame to tell his story. And he would send some of that stuff in my direction and say, I'm just saying, this isn't what I want.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I wanted you to see it happened. The only three times the story was ever told, Linda Moulton Howe told a very, very brief snippet on Whitley Strieber's Dreamland radio show. And it was literally just like a 30-second little snippet.
Yeah.
There was a reporter from Johnstown, excuse me. Her name was Renee Cluck. And she was a TV reporter at that time. She's now, I think she's a radio reporter. But she was young, and she had heard the story from one of the two men who owns the security firm. And she went out there, and that event that her of her going out there actually becomes part of the story. So with that background in mind, you know, the dark, stormy night and all the trauma and that's going to happen after it all happens and all the tumult that's going to go on. With your permission, I will start to tell the story of what Robert told me that night.
Yeah, I definitely want to hear this. I want to also ask before we begin that that part of the story. Take us, what year was this where you're in the pizza shop and you're having this conversation?
So, everything happened, of course, on 9/11.
Yeah.
And this would have been a few months later.
This was 2001.
Yes.
Okay. So this is literally just months after after everything had happened. So, and right. I like to set the scene because we have, as you probably know, there's a whole generation of our audience who, if they were alive, have no real recollection of the day or were far too young to really understand what that time felt like, what those months, what those years felt like immediately after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I understand. I completely understand where you're coming from. Of, you know, you find this story and this person just wants to tell their experience. Everyone at that moment in time. It was a very cathartic moment in history. And I'm not telling this for you. You know it. I'm telling it for the audience that's listening that may not have recollection of that point in time. It was such a cathartic point in time where everyone was talking about where were they, when it happened, how did they feel about it, how are they dealing with it now? And the thing is, the reality of what we're talking about here, this, albeit extremely rare, because there weren't many people who were right here in the experience you're about to talk about at these exact settings, you know, in the scope of all of the people that exist that would have an opportunity to have these experiences. But this was the reality. The term that's used today is this was their truth. This is what happened to them. And I right. think that they have a complete right to share their experiences and their stories. And obviously what you're saying, they weren't doing it in disregard. They weren't doing it in malice. They weren't doing it for attention or to make money. It was, look, this is my story. It may not be as, or it may not be like yours. It may not be the simple, here's where I was when I saw it on TV, or I was in the area and I heard it and I saw it, but here's what happened after for me. And this is, right. this is it. That's all it is. And it's not a judgment thing. It's not to hurt anyone. It's not to do, you know, raise, you know, eyebrows. It's just, here's my account. And that's what makes it really interesting. Now that we're sitting here, quite literally 20 years later, they have every right to have their part of their story told. So I'm really honored that you contacted us, that you listened to our programs, and you're able to recount this for us in your own words of that conversation. And what you found. So with that all being said, this is obviously, we're very respectful in this whole thing to anyone who's listening. Let's hear what happened in that pizza shop. Let's hear how that conversation went. And I'm going to interrupt very minimally.
Well, I sat down with Robert and he had a soda in front of him. And he told me that he was a bodybuilder, that he worked for the security company. He called it a rent-a-cop company. It was run by two state police officers in Cambria County who had started this private business on the side. And what had happened was that after the federal government took all of the debris and the bodies and everything out of there, they had left behind a house trailer that they had brought in and used as a place to store everything and archive it. And then package it up and send it on to, you know, Washington, D.C. for further analysis or wherever it was going to go. And when they left, they wanted to have security still at the site. Anybody who's from this area will tell you the security on that site for years was very, very tight. It's still very tight to this day, but it was amazingly tight at the beginning. You couldn't even drive up the road without being challenged. And so he had been approached by his bosses about going down there and taking a position working the night shift, because the previous security guard who had been there had been in a car accident and he could no longer do the job. He wasn't injured. That was the one thing that Robert was always a little hesitant about, is I asked him if the gentleman was hurt and he said, no, he wasn't injured. He quit. He just said he wasn't going back there and he quit. So I'm guessing, and this is only my personal opinion, he probably had an experience. There were other security guards that were there both day and night. And on either Robert's first or second day, he could not remember. He's down there to get trained. There's a couple security guards there. They're going to be his trainers. And he's in that house trailer I just discussed with you. And they hear this pounding on the door. He had just heard the first security guard say something that almost like a joke about, you know, the little ghosties that are around the place. And then they hear this pounding on the outside of the trailer. And Robert is a big man. He's got to be 250, 280. And he gets up and he walks to the door while the other guard is just sitting there staring at the door. And he flings open the door. Now, it has one of those portable sets of stairs in front of the door there that you would use at a trailer place. You know, if you're going to go look at trailers, they have those portable steps they can pull up and park in front. And that's what was sitting there in front of that trailer. There's nobody on the steps. There's nobody on the path. There's nobody. And as he's standing there, they hear a little scuttery noise behind them and they turn and look. And the folding chairs you buy in the sleeves that you can take to like sporting events, one of them has been opened up. It was a red one, and it was sitting in front of the coffee maker where they had just stood a couple seconds earlier and got a cup of coffee. It hadn't been there then. And the security guard kind of looks at Robert, and Robert looks at the security guard. And Robert's like, you know, how the hell did that happen? And the guard says, oh, it must have been kids. And Robert looks at him. He's like, what? He's like, dude, I'm a big guy. Nothing got past me. We've seen a kid. He's like, well, whatever, whatever. So there were two camps of security guards. One who was kind of making a joke out of it and or talk about it. And then there were a couple guards who worked there from time to time who just wanted nothing whatsoever to do with this story. So that's what began it. And then Robert was there from the beginning of November through to December the 31st was the last night he agreed to be there, because of something, in large part because of something that happened to him on December 31st. So he gets his instructions. He's supposed to drive around the site at night, making tours of the area to keep people out, because unfortunately there's always those people that want to get souvenirs of gory events and tragedies. And he's to just drive around every hour, make sure nobody's on the property. This was a part of a coal mine area that where this crash plane had come down, and is very, very rural. So you have to really want to be there to be out there. There should be no people mm-hmm. there at all.
And I want to just paint the picture here. And again, this is for the folks who were not around at the time, don't have recollections of the time. The area where this plane crashed and what was left of it was not a lot. I mean, it was a hole in the ground, quite literally, from everything that I remember at the time. It hit it. It disintegrated. It was a fire pit. So big crash site, and this stuff was spread around. But when people think airplane crash, quite often they think of big parts here and there. There really wasn't a lot left, correct?
No. I mean, there were a few bigger parts, but the vast majority of parts were little bits and pieces. It's amazing when you go to the Memorial. They have, it's a huge building they have now. And you see all the little tiny bits and pieces that they were able to find, wallets and key fobs and all kinds of little tiny things. They literally sifted that ground. That's how small many of the pieces were. So it was a daunting task and an emotional task. These were human beings who died a horrible death. And it was very emotional for the entire country, much like, you know, every other death that took part of that event in 9/11. And, we weren't immune from it here in Central PA. We were devastated because it happened in our backyard.
Sure.
And so, we all had a lot of our heart and our emotion in it. So Robert, you know, he was like everybody else. He knew, he anticipated it being kind of a rough go around just because of the emotion, but he did not anticipate the ghosts. He wasn't a big believer in the paranormal, and he told me that. So anyhow, I think the first thing that really struck him, aside from the chairs moving around in the kitchen of that little trailer, which happened to him multiple times, he would get up because there was a pounding on the door, open the door. There would be a chair kicked out from the table, or a folding chair would suddenly be opened up and sitting in the doorway between the kitchen and the what would have been a living room area or another open area. Or they would be particularly set in front of the coffee maker. That happened on multiple occasions. He would hear footsteps. He tells a story about one night him and a friend decided to play cards in the trailer. He had begun to avoid the trailer because it gave him a bad feeling, is what he always said. I guess it gave me a bad feeling. It was in a good place. But on this night, he had asked a friend to come and keep him company because he was getting a little edgy. And they sat up, do cards, set up a couple chairs at the little table. They made a pot of coffee and they heard the pounding. So he got up and so did his friend, and they went to the door and they looked out. There's nobody around. Now, it was dark, but there was a big, big light at the end of a pole light at the end of the trailer. So you could see very well. It was well lit in that area. And there were pole lights further out too, because he would tend to sit under one of the pole lights, particularly up by the gates, which also had pole lights. Anyhow, they're sitting there and they hear the thumping, throw the door open, nobody there. And they turn around and one of the metal chairs is unfolded and sitting there. And Robert was very cautious. If you read the actual interview, he says, I won't say to you that chair wasn't open. I'll say to you, I didn't notice it was open before we turned back around, because he wasn't sure. So he kind of shrugged it off and they sat down to start playing cards. And that's when they heard the 6 footsteps go through the living room area into the kitchen past them. And then they were just gone. They just stopped. And that creeped them both out so badly, they both got up and jumped in the car and went up to the gate and sat under the pole lights at the gate and spent the rest of the night driving around every hour and sitting under the pole light, because they didn't want to go back inside that building. And this would become a recurring theme. So he mentions it finally to one of the two owners. And the owner asks him some questions, and he's heard the story before. He makes note of the fact to Robert that Robert's not the first one to tell him there's something crazy going on down there. And in fact, a couple other security guards left because they didn't want to be part of that. And I don't know how it came into conversation, but the owner of the security company went to the local TV station and was talking to somebody there and was saying about it being haunted out there at the Flight 93 crash site, which got, of course, the reporters interested. And one of the young reporters there, Renee Cluck, was assigned to go out and tell the story. And I kind of believe, just from knowing the channel and how they handled those kinds of stories, and also from the time of, you know, year and everything, that it was just going to be one of those kind of cutesy little throwaway pieces. So they decided to send Renee out there like around midnight with a cameraman, and She agreed to go. She goes out and she comes inside the building with Robert, and the cameraman turns on the camera and he's getting everything ready to check the lighting and do all the stuff he has to do before they start to do the little interview and the reporting. And that's when they hear the pounding at the end of the trailer and she freezes. And then they hear it on the steps. What sounds like footsteps coming up those portable stairs, those metal portable stairs. And she turns kind of towards the doorway, even though the door is shut. And then something walks between her and Robert, something unseen, but they could clearly hear the footsteps go between them and out toward the kitchen. And Renee looked at the cameraman and said, "Please tell me you've got that." And his eyes were huge and he shook his head. He's like, "Yeah, man, I got that." And they stepped out. They ran outside and they did the rest of the interview real quick and she got out of there. And that actually aired the following night. And I saw it. Later, I had it, actually had a copy of it there. She sent me a copy later after the whole thing happened and I had interviewed Robert. I got a hold of her to verify his version of that story and she confirmed it and she sent me a copy of it. So I did get to see it. And it was that report that got Linda Moulton Howe interested and she contacted Robert. He didn't answer her. But through that little report that aired on the local news station, Linda Moulton Howe did her little 30-second thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the only time it was ever publicized.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, among the things that Robert talked about was this pervasive sense of evil and hate in the trailer. That was a recurring theme in my conversation with Robert that night. And he said that he would be outside and he would see these little shadows moving just at the edge of your vision. But they were moving and very fast. And he would turn the lights on them thinking that somebody was running or moving around and there would never be anybody there. And the minute you turn the light on them, the whole thing would just disappear. And it would always be coming up from the crash site towards the trailer or at the trailer. And that unnerved him a great deal. So he began to stay out of the trailer as much as he humanly could and still do his job. So he would go in, sign in, whatever he had to do, grab a cup of coffee and then head out. And he'd sit in his car and he'd do crossword puzzles or word searches or stuff like that under one of the pole lights and then do his tour around and continue to do this every night, all night long. And he only missed one night out of those nights from November the 9th until December 31st. And so he was there quite a bit. Well, among the things that happened, one of the first things he said happened is he was sitting in his car under the pole lights one night when doing a crossword puzzle. It was a pretty bright night. And from the back seat of his car, he heard a man say, "Is this all there is?" And he's like, "I threw my book and I whirled around thinking somebody had somehow snuck into the car. There wasn't anybody there. He didn't see anybody, but he said, I was wide awake. I was doing a puzzle. I'm not even remotely concerned that I was sleepy." And because he's like, "I wasn't sleepy on that site. You just didn't want to be. You were always on edge." And he said, "I heard this man clearly say, is that all there is?" And that scared him a little bit. So he moved his car and, continued his nightly occurrences with things moving, the thumping at the trailer when he had to go in, the pounding on the end of it, the sound of footsteps coming up the stairs. This was an every night occurrence, footsteps walking past him inside the trailer and the shadow figures moving, some very small, some very long and tall. And the next probably thing of note was he was backed up again up near the pole lights one night in a different spot near the gates, and it was a little mucky. It had rained, and you know, Pennsylvania in the late fall, early winter can be really swampy, and so it was kind of mucky and muddy, and he had backed in so he could get out if he had to. He wouldn't get caught in the mud, and he felt his words were, "I felt the ass end of my car go down like somebody had hopped up on the trunk." So he got out of it and he's looking at it kind of funny, like, you know, surely not both the shocks went down at the same time. And he's kind of looking at it and walking around it. And he kind of makes a couple tours back and forth around both sides of the car. And then he's standing there sort of staring at it, trying to figure out what the heck's got the whole back end of his car depressed, when all of a sudden he hears what he says sounds like 2 feet, as though somebody had slid off the trunk and kind of hit the ground in the muddy area. And it was that wet funk of feet on mud. And he said it took 3 steps and it was just gone. He didn't see anybody, but that was, you know, that was it. It was just gone.
Yeah.
And that frightened him. And this kind of stuff, you know, just became almost a nightly occurrence. And this continued night after night. And we kind of are coming up close to the last night was December 31st. It was a beautiful night. It had snowed a couple nights before, and it had snowed again that day. And it was a pretty close to a full moon, if not a full moon. So it was really bright. You know how it is whenever the moon's shining on the snow.
Yeah.
And he's sitting in his car. It's about 4 a.m. And there's this beautiful, uninterrupted, just completely smooth as a glass field of snow in his vision. And beyond that, just the darkness of the woods. And he's, you know, kind of looks up from his puzzles, and he's looking around, keeping an eye on things. And he sees this figure in the far distance along the edge of that field moving toward him. And he's watching it thinking, is this a person? Is this one of them shadows? But as it gets out into the field further where the moonlight can hit it, he realizes it's a woman. And she starts walking toward the car. And he winds down his window and he yells, "Hey, lady, you can't be here. You need to go." And she just keeps coming as though she hadn't heard him. And he said one of the first things that struck him was she didn't have a coat on. And it was like 20 degrees out. And she didn't have a coat on, just a baseball jersey and a pair of blue jeans and sneakers. And she kept coming, and he yelled a second time, "Hey, lady, you got to get out of here, man. You're trespassing." And he said in his head, he was thinking, you know, what the hell's a nice lady, a middle-aged lady doing out here in the middle of the woods without a coat on, traipsing around in this field?
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense. So, but it's his job. So finally, she's still getting closer, and she gets, you know, really close. He can see her face now, very close. He gets out of the car. She's still coming through toward him. And he yells, he shines his light and he yells, "Hey, lady, you're trespassing. You need to go." And she raised her head and met his eyes. And he froze. And then she just disappeared. This was his first person he had seen. This would be his last. He got in the car. And he just sat there. He didn't know where to go. Like, there was no good place left to go. You couldn't go inside that building. And he had formed a theory about why that trailer was so haunted by now. And so he wanted to stay away from there. And it wasn't safe at the gate because things hopped in your car and hopped on your car. And it wasn't safe down here at the other pole light because obviously the lady came out of the field. And he said, "I just sort of sat there." It was like 4, and he got off around 6:30, and he got home. And I know that people today wouldn't remember, but I'm sure that if you lived through this time period, you would remember there were a lot of memorial sites on the internet.
Sure.
And with their faces, the faces of every person who died at any of the sites. So he got onto a Flight 93 site, which he had deliberately not done to this point. And flipped through the site, and there stood that lady, her face on the screen. And he just sat there and looked at it. I do not know who she is. Mm-hmm. I asked him, and he said, "I'd rather not say." He said, "If her people come and talk to me and ask me, I'll confirm it for them." And I left it at that.
Yeah.
That was a good answer. And I'm kind of glad I don't know, to be honest.
Sure.
And you know, he called his bosses and said, "Dude, it's this way. Either you move me or I quit." And he quit.
Wow. What was his theory as to why the trailer was so haunted? You said he'd kind of developed a theory about that, as to why they kept going towards it.
Yeah. What he believes happened was that, and later on we would get some confirmation that this might actually have some merit. We know today from the flight recorders that the people on that plane realized what was going to happen, that they were going to be, their plane was going to be flown into something, and that they decided to take matters into their own hands. That's where the concept of the let's roll came from the Flight 93, you know.
Sure.
And the gentleman there who decided they were going to try to storm the cockpit and get these people before they got killed. Or even if they did get killed, it would stop another tragedy.
Yeah.
And I mean, not to take anything away from these gentlemen, these people that did this. God bless them. They were more courageous than I would have been. And what Robert believes happened is that these people were so intent on capturing them that even after they died, because they died so suddenly, that they believed they still had to somehow contain these terrorists. Mm-hmm. And he believed that what they did is they caught them and put those terrorists inside that trailer, and that the pounding outside and around it and the walking was them keeping guard over them, not letting them go. And he believed that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, when you look at hauntings as a whole, and if you take into context other stories that we've heard, things completely not related to 9/11, when there are sudden deaths, car accidents, what have you, quite often we hear about haunting spirits, ghosts around the area. And quite often they're very confused as to what happened, why they're there. They don't really know, but they're still conscious to a level. And so I understand where he's coming from on that, where they're still, they may not know why they're there. They may not know exactly what's going on. It's almost like that weird dreamlike state you can be in sometimes, where it's like everything else, all of your other consciousness is out the window. It's just, I'm here right now. Here's what's going on. And I know this is what I want to do. And that's kind of how I try to understand moments like that when we talk about hauntings of a very tragic, very quick incident where the ghosts seem to be very confused, but they're doing this, they're on this mission to do something. So that does make some sense.
You know, Pennsylvania, of course, also has Gettysburg, and I'm not too far from Gettysburg. And like I said, I've been ghost hunter for forever.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of sites down around Gettysburg where soldiers are still keeping watch, because that's their thing. That they were never, I've actually had on EVP soldiers say to me, I wasn't dismissed. You know, I'll say, why are you still here? My commander did not dismiss me.
They're still following the rules of life.
Yes.
Even on the other side. You had mentioned earlier that several had felt evil and hate in the trailer, which is an interesting thing, because when we think about this, I think a lot of us immediately go to, these are the souls of the innocent individuals who had passed on, or their energy, or something, some remnant of them. So why the evil and hate? Obviously, there were evil and hateful people on that plane as well, the ones who caused this to happen. But I guess, how does it all connect then to the trailer, where people were feeling the evil and hate about the trailer? The living were feeling that.
Robert believes that the passengers captured the terrorists and were housing them, basically keeping them in prison inside the trailer.
Quite literally, they were doing that on the other
literally.
Side. Okay. That's what I was missing in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they were using the structure as keeping their souls at bay, essentially, in that structure.
As though they were trying to keep them for the authorities or whatever, you know, or to keep them from doing other harm. But he believed that the terrorists were being imprisoned inside the trailer.
Okay.
And that the passengers that had captured them or forced them in there were keeping guard on them from the outside.
All these years later, obviously, the recovery effort is done. It's now a memorial site. Are there still stories from that, from the memorial, of people seeing or experiencing anything there?
Yeah, I mean, there are. There's personal experiences. First of all, the building itself is filled with things that were found at the crash site. Personal items, photographs, bits of the plane. It's anybody who understands energy would understand what I'm saying. It is immensely difficult to be in that building because it overwhelms you with the energy. And the further you go back into that building, closer to the crash site, the worse it gets. I've been there a couple times. I've never made it through the building. I've only made it halfway through the building and had to just turn around and walk out in tears. Not because the emotion overwhelmed me, because I just didn't want to go into that energy any further. There are people who go there and get EVPs. You know, there are stories.
Yeah.
Like there are stories from, you know, the site in New York, from the Twin Towers. There are stories there. There always have been.
Sure.
So the stories do exist. They're not told in a larger way, mostly because they're just personal stories from people. And sometimes I get to hear them because people look me up. But yeah, there are. And I've heard one particularly disconcerting EVP that very much sounded like the plane in the moments. It sounded like people in the cockpit of the plane moments before anything happened. And it was very disconcerting. If it wasn't legit, it was one heck of a counterfeit. And I was there when it was recorded, so I know it wasn't planted.
What did it sound like? What did you hear?
You hear what sounds like a pilot talking. A male talking, and it sounds like what it sounds like inside of a cockpit, the words, mm-hmm. the way it's said.
Sure.
And the person who was catching the EVP was a professional radio person, and he had that professional voice, and he's coming back at this person, and as he's talking, you can hear this person answering him, and it had that sounding, and they're talking about, you know, Mayday, Mayday, you know, that kind of a thing, like saying that they're in trouble, that we need help.
When you hear these things and you have these experiences, this is really a personal opinion question, but do you feel like these individuals or these souls are still there and they are confused and wandering the area where they had perished? Or is this something where this is, it's the energy, it's the impact, it's the imprint, it's essentially the record that is kind of replaying itself over and over to those who are either sensitive enough to hear it or there's something that is picking it up?
I think there might be a little bit of both. I certainly don't believe that every person who perished there is haunting that site by any means. But I think that there's just this overwhelming, pervasive sadness that overtakes you when you get there. It's interesting to stand outside the building because I've done that several times and watch people going in. The families that come in, they're tourists, and they come in and they're the mom and the dad are usually fairly serious, but the kids are goofing off and laughing and being kids. And about 20 feet from the door, it stops. The kids are suddenly quiet. They don't know why they're quiet, but they're quiet. And you can watch everybody getting more subdued the further back into the building they go. I think almost, I won't say everybody because there's obviously people who don't feel energy at all, but most people can catch a sense of the sadness and the immensity of what happened here. I've quietly heard stories from people who staff the place. I've heard stories from tourists who've gone there. And it's never stopped.
Have you heard from anyone, and I'm not asking for a personal recount or anything like that, but have you heard from anyone who did lose someone on that flight? That has visited that area, that has had any sort of experience or encounter of some sort?
I have not. And I don't think that they would probably say, and that's okay.
Sure.
I told the story because Robert asked me to tell the story. And I want to, the one thing I want to walk away from this before I end this is to make sure people understand. I probably wouldn't have told the story if it had been anybody but Robert Wagstaff. This man's sincerity just took me by surprise. This man was so concerned to tell the story for the families, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And I gave him my word on that night I would do it, and I've done it. And I don't blame the families if they don't want to talk. I don't blame the families if they don't believe their family members are there.
Sure.
And maybe they're not. The immensity of what they all survived is beyond our ability to understand. But I've heard consistently from the very beginning, obviously, stories, and they have never stopped.
That concludes this episode of The Grave Talks. Again, there is no part two. We're presenting it in its entirety to anyone who chooses to listen to this story. A thank you to Patty Wilson for recounting her interview with Mr. Wagstaff on our program. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.